From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour as we move into the fall season, one of my favorite times of the year. Isn't it great that God gave us all these different times of the year to look forward to? You get used to one, and it goes away, and on comes another one, and you end up saying, "Oh, I really like this change of season." So, appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. So much going on in our lives and in the Diocese of Sacramento. Some open houses coming up, sponsored by Catholic Funeral and Cemetery Services, coming up this weekend, October 2nd and 3rd. October 2nd at St. Joseph's Cemetery in Woodland, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. will be an open house. Plan your funeral, mortuary, cremation, cemetery services today. Act now. Prices increase November 1st, and you can reserve a private tour today by calling 530-438-4998. St. Joseph's Cemetery is 860 West Street in Woodland. Drop-ins are welcome as well, but you can walk in or you can make an appointment to be sure you got somebody to talk to. Again, 10 to 4, October 2nd at St. Joseph's in Woodland. October 3rd at the same 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Holy Cross Cemetery in Colusa. That's at 1741 Westcott Road in Colusa. Also, and these will all be both days, October 2nd and 3rd, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at All Souls Cemetery and Funeral Center, which is at 550 Glen Cove Road in the great city of Vallejo. That 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., October 2nd and 3rd. And then October 2nd and 3rd at St. Mary's Cemetery, 6509 Fruit Ridge Road in Sacramento, at Calvary, 7101 Verner Avenue in Citrus Heights. And again, for those of you in the Vallejo area, Fairfield, that area, 550 Glen Cove Road in Vallejo. You can call them at 707-644-5209. At Calvary, it's 916-452-4831. Or call a Catholic Funeral and Cemetery Services for any of the others, 530-438-4998. So some excellent opportunity to find out all about all of those. Give a great Catholic Herald out.
Yeah.
I love reading Bishop Soto's column, and there's just always a lot of humor in it, even though he's making a very serious point.
He's a funny guy.
And, and a great sense of humor. And then Monsignor Murphy, who shared with us, he's doing a two-parter on Dorothy Day. And this is the second installment, I believe, of the Dorothy Day. The headline, intriguing headline, "What was Dorothy Day's biggest sin? The answer might surprise you." So
I found her expose that we talked about, Father Murphy, really interesting, because she was very not the type of character you would think of as ending up the way she did.
Yeah,
as inspiring as she was.
Very inspiring. Tells you there's hope for everybody. And I remember a number of years ago, I'm still writing a newspaper column, but I was writing a newspaper column and got the idea that if you could name 10 people in history to have dinner with,
mm-hmm.
who would you pick?
Who did you pick?
Well, Dorothy Day was one of them.
Yeah.
And my editor called, and I just named them. I didn't talk about them. I just said, these are the 10 I'd pick. Mm-hmm. And then encouraged the readers to tell me who they'd pick.
Mm-hmm.
And I said Dorothy Day, and my editor called me and said, "Well, aren't you going to tell people who Dorothy Day is? I have no idea who Dorothy Day is." And I said, "Well, I think that's a good thing for people. Maybe they'll look it up."
Right.
You know,
yeah, for sure.
Because beyond everything else, I'm not quite sure. I could say, you know, founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, or a few. I'm not quite sure what label to hang on her that would be accurate,
mm-hmm.
that would really tell you why I would want to have dinner with Dorothy Day.
It'd be like calling Mother Teresa a nun.
Yeah.
It's like a lot more to it.
A Catholic nun, period. You know, end of, right. end of discussion. You know, that was a good point. And I didn't discuss whether or not I would have all 10 of them at once.
That would be a pretty big table.
Or just one at a time. Because you may end up with, if you had all 10 at once, you may have some dominators.
Although it would be interesting to see what, and I'm going to go with a complete guess here that Arthur Ashe was on your list.
Yeah. Good.
There you go. Well, I know you love tennis and you grew up in that
great
era.
Civil rights.
You had a civil rights background and you have a tennis background. So I figured Arthur Ashe would be here. It'd be interesting what she and Arthur Ashe would talk about.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
I guess Arthur Ashe probably was not quite a contemporary.
Yeah.
Not sure.
They lived at the same time, but maybe not in there on
the. I forgot when Dorothy Day actually died. They may have overlapped a little bit. Arthur Ashe and I were about the same age.
Yeah.
I remember I played on the tennis team at UC Davis, and at the start of the year, first get together was what they called the All Cal. And it'd be at Santa Barbara or UCLA or Irvine or one of the UC campuses. We never did have it in Davis. And Berkeley and UCLA were the big powers, and mm-hmm. Irvine was a little bit behind them, and then we were further down the list. And I remember showing up at UCLA, and there was Arthur Ashe on another court.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and he, of course, went on to win Wimbledon. And but was a great humanitarian. And
I remember when I was a kid, I wasn't really a big tennis watcher. My wife was a really big tennis player and, played junior college, but in high school and stuff like that. And afterward, so I didn't really get into tennis till, later in life. And I really loved watching tennis now. But when I was a kid, I didn't know much about him. It's kind of the same thing you're saying about the Dorothy Day. It's like people know who that is, so look it up and you can find out about them. Remember when I was a kid, I remember hearing when he had passed and I didn't understand his contribution to the world.
Yeah.
And then when he had passed, as I was a kid, I was like, oh, a sports figure had passed away and he seemed like he was an important guy. But, Google didn't really exist back then, things like that. So then I got older and I somebody had mentioned him to me and it like sparked this thing where I was like, I always wanted to look up what that guy was about. And I looked it up and I was like, wow.
Well, and he was from Richmond, Virginia.
Yeah.
Which was, the heart of the Deep South. Virginia is kind of a real mixed state now because so much overflow from Washington, D.C. A lot of people live in, I guess, northern Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But, Robert E. Lee's statue was there, and there's which was just taken down.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Arthur Ashe's statue, which was very controversial going up in Richmond, about a native son. And you think about a black man in the South and the tennis, that long history of being in private clubs, tennis and golf really were, and swimming had that kind of reputation as well.
Yeah.
Even though swimming, there were a lot more public pools than there were public tennis courts.
And, the country club sports.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's broken down a lot. Golf has become every man's game. Tennis mm-hmm. has become an every man's game or a woman's game. And Arthur Ashe did a lot to break that all down.
Did you see there's that new movie coming out about the Williams sisters?
There is.
With the Will Smith is playing their father, and it looks interesting.
It's the same thing.
Same thing, yeah.
Between Serena and Venus, Williams took the world by storm and were two of the greatest. Well, you make the case that Serena, greatest tennis tennis player ever.
Oh, yeah. I remember there was times when we would watch, different majors, and it was like,
nobody was close.
Yeah, it was like, so-and-so's doing. Oh, yeah. And it would be like some women would be having an amazing tournament, and you're like, oh, who should play in the finals? Like Serena. I'm like, oh, that sucks for her, So out of curiosity, other than, the sort of the religious figures and all that, who can you think of anybody else who's in your 10?
Well, I obviously Jesus Christ.
Well, right. Yeah, that'd be a good one.
Obviously, Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
I'm trying
any normal sort of not known for religious?
Roger Bannister. Roger Bannister. Do you know who that is?
I know the name. Roger Bannister. Was he a tennis player,
very,
too?
Very religious man.
Was he a tennis player? No.
No, he was the first man to break the four-minute mile.
Okay, athlete. He was an athlete. Okay, Roger Bannister. Okay.
Englishman.
Yeah. Well, not too many American sirs.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure I had Pope John Paul II.
Yeah,
on the list.
I could see that.
I didn't. You know, it was. I'm writing for a secular publication, not a Catholic publication. So
that's why I was curious.
Like,
yeah,
my top ten here, Jesus Christ is followed by many, many people who are not Catholic.
I could see the one-on-one with Jesus would be a little bit more of a.
Yeah,
I think that because I think with the other ten, everybody else would just look at him and be like, so like yeah. ask him everything. So they like, I feel like the one-on-one would be a good.
Well,
dinner.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, if Jesus, I mean, you're gonna have to eat bread and fish. I mean,
right.
he's gonna dictate the menu. You know, so
I think it'd be kind of funny if he sat down. He's like, "So what do we have?" And you're like, "I think kind of up to you, right?"
Yeah, wouldn't it be interesting? To have a one-on-one, which, you know, I've met people who don't believe in Christianity. I've met people who, oh, you're Catholic, and they give you all kinds of grief for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And there were, you know, a long history of anti-Catholicism, and the Klan was very anti-Catholic.
Yeah.
I mean, in the 1920s, they banned Catholic schools in the state of Oregon, believe it or not.
Yeah, which is funny. You think about Oregon, I think it would be in such a progressive state.
Yeah, it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was the governor's name, I think, was Pierce. So it was Pierce v. the Little Sisters of mm-hmm. Brothers of Jesus and Mary, or something like that. And you're going, who do you think's going to win that?
Yeah, right. Not the side you want to be on.
Yeah, and but you know, there were a lot of anti-Catholicism. But my point is, I have never met anyone who dissed Jesus, who didn't like Jesus.
Right.
You know, even if they didn't believe that Jesus was deity.
Right.
Even if they didn't believe that, they may have believed he died on the cross, but they didn't believe he died on the cross for our sins.
Right.
You know, they just believed he died on the cross because people didn't like him, you know.
The next 3 days was the important part.
Exactly.
Right.
And so, I've never met anybody who didn't like Jesus. They can't find anything in anything he said
mm-hmm.
or anything he stood for that they disagree with.
It's true. When you hear people who don't like Christianity itself, they will say something along the lines of, look, what Jesus said was great and all.
Yeah, I don't like organized religion.
Right.
Or, you know,
they dismiss the teachings by going, he's great.
Human beings have gotten into it and messed it up.
Right, right, yeah.
That kind of thing. But with Jesus, it's like it's universal. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah,
there aren't very many historical figures that there aren't kind of two sides. You know, well,
yeah,
I didn't
yeah.
think he was so great, or she was so great, or,
right.
or whatever.
Well, and just people's general want to be contrarian to a lot of things. You know, people want to root for the underdog. And this is in no way comparing the two men, but I hear people all the time say they don't like cheering for Tom Brady because he's just won too many.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, what does that have to do with anything? You know, it's like, so it's like you get people who just want to cheer against a winner or want to be the person who roots for the underdog for no other reason other than they just want to see the person.
Different.
Yeah, or to be different. Or the person who is exalted in whatever vocation or whatever they're doing, knock down a peg. No one does that with Jesus. You never hear it. Yeah, you never hear it.
It's remarkable. But I can't even imagine what a one-on-one with Jesus, the man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and his disciples had a lot of one-on-ones with him or a lot of 12-on-ones with him,
mm-hmm.
you know. They did. I mean, they saw him regularly. They they conversed with him. They followed him. They sometimes challenged him. They many times failed him. I mean, here he is. You know what, Peter? You'll deny me three times before the cock crows.
Right.
Wow. You know, at the most crucial point in Jesus's life, Peter, I don't know the guy.
Who's, right.
Who?
Yeah.
I've never heard of him. I'm hiding under this rock here. You know, I mean, which I take from that a lot of like empathy. I mean, it's in the good book. There he is, Peter. Upon this rock I shall found my church. He's failing Jesus.
Right.
And he's still Jesus's guy. It's not like, okay, I'm done with you,
right,
Peter. You know, that should have been the bad story.
Right.
But it wasn't. It was like, and then they all fell asleep. You know, what's the matter with you people? You know, so I mean, there are a lot of stories of people who failed Jesus, but Jesus didn't fail them.
Out of curiosity, you've been in journalism now for, what, 40, 50 years? I mean, it's been a long time. Yeah, right, yeah. So since you're like two. Have you ever thought about, like, because, you know, you hear people talk about, like, oh, I'm going to talk to this person, but everyone's talked this point of their life to death, so I'm gonna hit another angle, or I'm going to do that. Like, what do you think there's a spot of his life or his philosophy or his teachings that you'd want to focus your interview on from the beginning? Jesus,
you gonna book him?
I mean, hey, I'm working on it.
It's you first, then me.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I just follow the leader here. You say, I guess you want to book.
I'm just curious because I find it interesting. Like, what do you think the centralized idea of what you'd want to talk to him would be?
Our guest today is Jesus Christ in person. He is wearing a mask, but
of course,
in person,
of course,
double vaccinated. and yeah, let's see, Jesus. Yeah, that would be. You know, that would be. That would be very interesting. Like talk to a number of radio hosts and say, okay, we booked, for today we've booked, the mayor of Sacramento, and we've booked somebody from St. Mel's who's having a men's conference this weekend, and we've booked Jesus Christ,
right,
in person,
right.
Wow, what would you ask him?
Because I feel like, you know, everyone would ask him, like, hey, what is the meaning, or what is the this, or what is the that?
Well,
but
Jesus,
I feel like
he wouldn't want you to be intimidated.
That's true.
He would not want you to be intimidated, to be overwhelmed by the venue. You know?
Right.
He would want you to be comfortable. He would want you to be able to intellectually talk to him.
Yeah.
And I guess I would ask him, what are the most critical issues today?
Ah, that's a good one.
And I don't know. He might say, well, the same ones that when I was living.
Right.
You know, love God, serve your fellow man. All these problems would go away. Mm. I'm concerned about the Haitian immigration. I'm concerned about people who are homeless. I'm concerned about people who are sick. I'm concerned about wars. I'm concerned about people not loving each other. But I was also concerned about this in the first century, and this in the second century, and this in the third century. So it's really the what I gave you was timeless. You know, that it's not like oh, this is the more important time than when anybody else lived it. There's a lot of hubris to say that.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, they did that stuff in the 5th century, but that was just child's play. What we're dealing with now is what's really important.
I feel like he would do a lot, too, of what a lot of parents I find myself doing with my kids is when they ask a question, I would ask them what they think. You know, well, what do you think about this? Well, what do you think?
Yeah.
Because I feel like not a lot of people nowadays ask themselves those questions.
I'd be confident that... There are certain things that you're not sure how he would answer, because his willingness to die for all sins and all sinners makes him, and to tell the rest of us to judge not, that it's up to the Father to judge, he's not a condemnatory person.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you say, well, isn't this really bad, or isn't this really right, or isn't so-and-so really wrong, I'm not sure you'd get the response you wanted out of Jesus.
Yeah.
But he'd say, well, you know, they're all children of God. Those are all my brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And, Bill, they're maybe went a little astray there. But, Bob, you know, do you have a mirror? You know?
Well, I think the thing you said earlier was pretty telling, where you said he would say, I'm concerned about this, I'm concerned about that, not necessarily offering a thing and says, this is how this is supposed to go, this is how this is supposed to go. It's more of a concern, because at the end of the day, I think we're all supposed to realize what was being said and how it's not being applied. And if it had been applied, a lot of these pitfalls that we're running into would be avoided.
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, if the entire world had from day one followed the Ten Commandments,
mm-hmm.
yeah, we'd have people die. We still would. We'd probably still have disease.
Mm-hmm.
But we wouldn't have, I can't imagine we would have wars.
Mm-hmm.
We would have hatred. The Ten Commandments are, I mean, if you followed all of them, if you just followed the words of Jesus, I've never read anything. There are things that Jesus has said that I go, that's hard. That's going to be hard to do.
Yeah, we talked about that with like the Gabriel. But, was it the
yeah?
What's the one that Rabbi Castleman?
The Exodus Project.
Exodus Project. We talked about that with that kind of thing, where a lot of people can't forgive people in jail.
Yeah,
and
it's going to be really hard.
Yeah,
to do.
It's hard.
You know, I mean, Jesus says, it's great that you love your family, but you don't get a lot of credit for that.
Right.
You don't get a lot of credit for loving people who are nice to you.
Yeah.
Love your enemy, and you're like, but you have to admit that, because a lot of people say, well, I'll forgive them when they apologize,
right.
But not until, you know, and or well, I'm a nice person. I let the people go ahead of me in the line at the grocery store. I give the guy on the street corner $5 so he can get something to eat. I'm a nice guy. I'm nice to my friends. My friends think I'm a nice guy, but mm-hmm. my enemies,
right?
Are you kidding?
It's a hard one.
I'm supposed to love them. I'm supposed to give them the shirt off my back. That's a hard one. But you do have to admit that if you did that, it'd be a better world.
Oh, absolutely.
Like somebody's got to start somewhere. Somebody has to break the chain of hate. You know, if it's okay to hate those who hate you, it never ends.
Yeah, and it's you're right. And it's one of those things where people I think want to go, okay, how do I fix this? What's the easy way to do it? And it's like, it's not always the easy way to do it. You know, yeah. it's never isn't always the way you want it to be or how easy you think it's going to be. It sometimes is hard work, and it's like any other relationship. It's hard if you want to work.
Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Like I'll forgive, but I won't forget. You know, well, that's not really forgiving.
And it's okay to not forget, but if you're holding a grudge and not forgetting are two different things, I think. I think it's one of those things where you can remember what someone's done to you and you can forgive them for it and not hold a grudge. But it may change your relationship going forward. You may not.
True forgiveness, I may be wrong. Right? To me, true forgiveness is somehow, and I don't know if we're humanly possible to do this, is to literally have it leave your memory.
You think so?
Yeah. And that's almost impossible.
Yeah.
Almost impossible. But we expect that. We kind of expect that of God.
Right.
Like, oh, don't hold on to what I did in 10th grade.
Right.
Don't
like a confessional.
Hold on to what I did in college. Right. Confession, it's done.
I mean,
if it's a sincere confession and, you know, and you're truly sorry and you will endeavor not to do it again. Not like, oh, okay, I did it 10 times, and I'll go confess it and I'll start over. You know,
right.
When I get to 10, I'll confess it again. It's not how it works.
I mean, I've had a friend before where we were really close, and then he did a few things that just changed the dynamic of the friendship.
Sure.
And I just couldn't bring myself to being friends with him anymore. But I still care about him as a human. I still, if something were to happen, I would help out and all those kind of things. It's just we used to hang out on a daily basis, and now I never see him.
I think we can all point to, you know, some relationship. I mean, sometimes a friendship just fades away.
Yeah.
But sometimes something happened that it changed your perception of who they were,
or it
changed their perception of who you were.
Or how much you actually put into something, and then you don't realize how little was given back. You know, not that it's a transactional kind of thing, but it's just one of those things where like you sort of just are always there for someone and always doing stuff for someone because they're your friend. And then when one small thing happens, it's the complete opposite. You're like, wow, okay, maybe I defined this a little wrong, you know, kind of thing. And yeah, and it's...
So, if we just followed everything Jesus told us to, and it, I guess you could say they were commandments, but they weren't commands. They were just, they were like guidelines. They
lessons.
Were, you know, lessons. You know, I mean, if Matthew 25 is just, I come back to Matthew 25 all the time, where he says, you know, feed the hungry. Okay, that's pretty obvious. Clothe the naked, that's pretty obvious. But visit people in prison. Not because they're wrongly convicted, not because they're nice people, not because you'll get something out of it. Just visit people in prison. They need people to visit them. It's not one that comes to mind logically, but Jesus told us to do it.
When you think about it, they are in a sort of a existentialist, spiritual kind of way, hungry and
very.
And they are, you know, they're naked and hungry and ignored.
Lock them up and throw away the key. How many times have you heard that?
Unfortunately, more times than that too.
You know, I mean, you see some of these crimes, and it turns your stomach. Well, you're going to work on that. We're going to book Jesus and. Have him right here, right in the speaking into the gold microphone. He doesn't need a microphone. Yeah. Yes. Well, if anybody has the inside, and you know something, this is the really interesting thing. You can book Jesus every day. You can. He's there. He's there, and he's listening, and he's responding. Whether you think he is or not, he is. So. Maybe that's a lesson for all of us is book Jesus today. You know, have your producer book Jesus because he's there and he's waiting. He's waiting for your questions. He's waiting for you to talk to him. He's more than willing to have that dialogue and to answer you. We'll take a quick break. Back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this.
This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour.
This is Deacon Kevin Stasko, the Director of the Office of Youth and Young Adult Ministry and Family and Faith Formation, and you're listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.
Thank you, Deacon Kevin, and congratulations on another great on-fire event at Six Flags Discovery Kingdom in Vallejo Saturday before last. Just heard nothing but good things about it, and it's hard to pull that off with nine dioceses, and just great to hear how well that went. Well, we are just pleased and honored to welcome back Lincoln Snyder, who is the president and CEO of the National Catholic Educational Association, used to be the superintendent of schools here in the Diocese of Sacramento until about June, so not very long ago. Lincoln, good day to you.
Hey, good day. Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear your voice, Lincoln. How are your new, not new digs, but your new whatever you want to call it?
Well, things are going well. Yeah, so yeah, I've been in the new gig since the 1st of July,
right.
It's been good work, though busy work, as we try to help all of our schools get back into session, facing another round of COVID, and that's been our big topic of conversation for the last 18, 20 months. But you know, our Catholic schools are open and doing well despite the Delta variant's best attempts.
That wasn't in your contract, the resurgence of COVID.
Indeed. You know, Sacramento, like every other diocese in the country, was thinking that things were looking pretty good.
Yeah.
Yet we were, caught a little bit unawares by Delta. You know, I think the good news is that Catholic schools had a wonderful safety record. And so based on all of our experience the last year and a half, despite the pandemic's best attempts, our schools are open for business. Kids are in session. And you know, we've had challenges, of course, but generally speaking, we had a playbook, and we've been executing on it.
Well, you know, it is interesting that I hate to put it in political terms, but there is disagreement about masks and vaccinations and mandates or no mandates and all these different things. But the one thing that almost everybody seems to agree on, which is hard to find these days, is that children are best off in school, in person, in school. How to accomplish that, there's disagreement on, but that seems to be universal, that people feel that that's best for the kids.
Absolutely, and very proud to report our schools, the Diocese of Sacramento, had no learning loss this past year. So the test results are in, and our friends from Renaissance, who does our testing for our Catholic school kids, our kids gained the year that they spent in class. And so just for our listeners, a third grader who spent all of the third grade of COVID year was at fourth grade level when they started fourth grade, which is really remarkable when you consider how much disruption there was. I mean, a lot of public school districts didn't get back until April of this year,
right,
after having been out since March of the previous year.
Right.
You know, we know that, for parents, that was a real source of consternation. We're just very proud to report that as Catholic schools, our kids were in class, and I'm happy to talk about all the mitigation efforts we put in place, and people liked some and didn't like others, and, you know, and we know that there was a big debate there. But at the end of the day, doing all of those things meant our kids could be in desks, and they have progressed. They did not lose the year, which was really remarkable.
Well, it's almost a miracle, because in so much of what you've read in other places and in other school districts, et cetera, and like you say, I know you, and we all root for the public schools, but there were a lot of lost years there for a number of kids. I think especially in, correct me if I'm wrong, at the high school level, not in the Catholic high schools, but in the ones that didn't go back that long out, that there was a, I don't know if it was a full year loss, but there was a loss.
And there was. And, you know, one of the sad things about kids is once you lose that year, you never get it back.
Yep.
And so, you know, in other words, 12th grade would have to become 13th grade for the same child to finish at the same place. And that's not the change that was made. You know, kids were still going from their senior year of high school onto their freshman year of college. There's no grade 13. And
right,
so we
right.
felt tremendous pressure to deliver for those kids, making sure that we were going to get them as far as we could. And, you know, of course, safety is first. And we know that masking, for example, is a very personal issue for a lot of parents, and there's different opinions. You know, what I will say our experience proved is that there's no silver bullet for mitigating COVID. There's not one thing that you can do.
Right.
But there are a lot of little things that you can do that in concert add up to kids being in class and safe. And so that was the lesson for us. It was the temperature checks, the distancing, the hygiene, the masks, all these things added up to our kids being in school. And we know that testing is an inconvenience. We know that people, worry about the effect that masks might have on our kids. We were in school for a year, and kids were masked, and they did keep up with their learning, so we know it didn't affect them academically. We're just grateful that parents trusted us as a Catholic school system nationally to do all of these things, knowing that our goal was to keep their kids in class and learning. And I will say, as a country, as a Catholic school system, we were able to do that.
Lincoln, what's the mission of the NCEA?
Well, we are the association for all Catholic schools. So there's 6,000 Catholic schools nationally, 1.7 million students. As a trade association, we have 130,000 members. And so we are there to connect all of our schools and all of our the employees of the schools to the people and the resources they need to have great schools. You know, so I'm not the boss of the superintendents. That's not my role. You know, every superintendent reports to a bishop, and the
right.
bishop is,
right.
of course, the authority over the schools in his diocese. And so we're a democratic organization in the sense that our 180 dioceses, or 176 with schools, are all members of this association. Mm-hmm. And we're really there to bring people together and make sure they're connecting to all the resources they need to have great schools.
So all dioceses are part of this organization in the U.S.?
They are.
Oh, very
they
good.
Are. So the organization is 120 years old. It was founded to, from the beginning, collect data and coordinate on efforts to make our schools better. And so we have a few things we do that are really essential for our schools. We're very much involved in the public policy conversation. So uh-huh. I was at a meeting last week of an association called CAPE that's the heads of all the private school organizations. So we were there with Jewish education, Muslim education, Episcopalian, Seventh-day Adventist, Lutheran. So everybody's at the table advocating for the interest of private education as such. So we collaborate with all of the schools in that private ed space to make sure that we're staying on the administration's radar and the Department of Education's radar for the things we need. Beyond that, we collect data, we offer conventions, we offer professional development. So we do a lot of things to make sure that schools have resources and have the connections they need to have great schools.
Do you have any collaboration at all with the USCCB?
We do. So we have a very strong relationship with that's the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. And so they have an education committee that's responsible for the souls of all children who are learning about the faith. And they're focused on, of course, making sure that catechesis is strong in all of our dioceses. And they provide resources to our dioceses. So, yeah, we work hand in glove with mm-hmm. What's called the Education Committee of the USCCB. And we're not a subsidiary, but we work parallel. And so our own Californian Bishop Barber, who mm-hmm. is a graduate of St. John Vianney School, Rancho Cordova,
right.
now is the ordinary in Oakland, has been the chair for the last few years. And then in November, Bishop Daly, who was in San Francisco and then briefly in San Jose and is now in Spokane, is taking over as the chair of the Bishop's Education Committee. Yeah, so they're very important to us. We collaborate with them directly, and they're the ones that do the lobbying and do the actual direct public advocacy. You know, our lane is we represent the schools, not just the diocesan schools, but also the order schools and the private schools. In other words, you know, not every school is owned by a bishop. So Christian Brothers is owned by the Christian Brothers, and Jesuit is owned by the Jesuits. And so we're the organization that brings everybody to the table so we can all collaborate. And we work very closely with the bishops to make sure that we're advocating well for schools.
So how many Catholic school students do we have now in the United States?
1.7 million.
1.7 million.
Preschool through 12, and about 6,000 schools. And you know, Catholic education has evolved quite a bit. If you were a Catholic child in 1950, the expectation was that you were going to be in a Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 1950s, there were something like 6 million Catholic school students in 12,000 schools. And as a Catholic family, you needed a dispensation from your pastor to be able to send your child to a public school.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for this was because our kids faced just tremendous discrimination in public school space in the 1800s. And so, Supreme Court cases that are just shocking if you were to read them today that really did discriminate against Catholics. And so the bishops of the country at a convocation in Baltimore in the 1880s said every parish had to have a school. And so they built this network of Catholic schools in the 19th century, continuing on in the 20th, but that made sure that every Catholic child had a chance for education in the faith, but also in all the traditional secular subjects, free of discrimination. So that's really where our Catholic School Network came from, and it's actually very unique globally. Not every country has a big network of Catholic schools like we do. But because Catholics faced this legacy of discrimination in the 1800s, the Church responded by building this big network of schools that we still have today, and it really is a legacy of our great-great-great-grandparents deciding to organize things for themselves so kids can learn about the faith and freedom.
Yeah, I was just discussing earlier in the program about the state of Oregon in the 1920s essentially banning all Catholic schools. And that was a time when my dad was living in Portland as a 10-year-old, and as a Catholic 10-year-old. And to imagine, you think, they actually banned the Catholic. I mean, it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. You've read those cases, I know, it's just mind-boggling.
And some of these decisions are still in the books. It's interesting. Just in recent years, the U.S. Supreme Court has started passing some rulings, decisions that actually unwind some of that 100-year-old discrimination against Catholic schools. And so there was a big case in Montana now 2 years ago, I believe, that made sure that a Catholic school wouldn't be discriminated against in terms of the support it could receive just because it's Catholic.
Right.
And most states have an amendment. It's called the Blaine Amendment, where the state might be able to give support to a private school that's non-sectarian, but it can't give it to a Catholic school. And the courts have started saying no. If you're going to make it something available to a private school, you should make it available to all private schools. So you can't discriminate against a private school just because it's religious in nature.
Right, I remember
that was a law of land for 100 years, and so Catholic schools definitely had to do their own thing without really getting much government support.
Yeah, there was a case about 10 years ago, I can't remember the name of it now, but it had to do with a city, or I guess it was a state, was providing funds to resurface the blacktop and school playgrounds. And it was a religious school. I don't believe it was a Catholic school. A religious school had applied for the funds and was denied because it was a religious school. Even though the funds weren't going to be used, they were going to be used to make kickball and, shooting hoops on the playground safer. It was to ban skinned knees, if you will. And the court decided in favor of, the private school. This was a secular purpose that makes the society better and safer and et cetera. It wasn't advancing one religion. They weren't teaching religion on the playground. It wasn't like they built a chapel for the school. And the courts smiled on it, which was great.
Yeah, and there's more of that. So there's some critical cases out there right now, including a big one coming up this year. And one of the fun things about my new job is we got to meet with the attorney that's advocating for Catholic schools in this new case. But, essentially, the law is starting to turn in that, as you said, that the playground asphalt has nothing to do with the faith. That's a benefit that really accrues to the kid.
Right.
And one of the interesting things about COVID, for example, is that private schools have actually benefited from all sorts of funding. It's not about financing the school, but it's about providing a benefit to the child.
Right.
And so, when you're in a pandemic and, 14% of kids nationally are in private schools, COVID doesn't care in which desk you sit. And so, the government did come up with a lot of programs that benefit the kids regardless of which school they're in,
sure,
because the goal was stopping the pandemic and the goal was helping kids. And so we are very blessed in that, there's been different buckets of funds that have been there to help our kids regardless of what school they're in. And so, a lot of my new role is making sure that we're advocating for the policies that would really make sure we're serving the interests of all children.
Right.
Making sure that our Catholic school kids get to participate in that.
Are there issues where you're at loggerheads with, major organizations representing public schools?
Well, I mean, I think that some of my differences of opinions with the California Teachers Association were well documented over the past 18 months. You know, it's not that way everywhere or all the time. Which, you know, we have a number of CAF schools nationally that are under collective bargaining, and we collaborate with our trade unions. They know that the Catholic Church is not anti-union, of course, as a church. You know, obviously we believe in the right to you know, dignity and justice for workers, and a union can be a part of that. So we're not anti-union.
Right.
You know, that stated, we do want to make sure that private schools or Catholic schools that aren't unionized are still receiving equitable treatment for their students. Right. So I think that for us, when we say, well, you know, are we in conflict? Well, you know, when we do have conflicts, it's usually just because it's our job to advocate very firmly for the benefit going to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that the important thing to keep in mind, especially through a pandemic, is that we really do serve our families first. That's the party to whom we're accountable, because if they don't come to school, we're not getting tuition.
Right.
And we need to make sure that we're, and of course we're not trying to accommodate in ways that aren't keeping the safety and growth of the kids front and center. We always do that, but we also know that the first person who serves that child in a particular desk in their relationship with Jesus Christ, and that's the focus. In other words, the end of education is the child having a relationship with God,
right,
and not any other interest. And so I think some of the conflicts we've had, I'll say quite proudly, have been us really trying to make sure we stay focused on that, because, you know, we make no apologies for being Christ-centered and child-centered in our approach to education.
We're talking with Lincoln Snyder, the president and CEO of the National Catholic Educational Association. He's been on the job since July 1st. Prior to that was the superintendent of schools here in the Diocese of Sacramento. Lincoln, you mentioned, being part of a group that, represents all private schools. In terms of private religious schools, what's second behind the Catholic Church in terms of is it the Lutheran Church, is it Jewish, what who has the most schools?
That's a great question. It varies from region to region. I will say that in terms of the numbers of schools, there's some faiths that actually have beautifully big networks of small schools, like the Seventh-day Adventists, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They have a big network of one-room schoolhouses.
Right.
Actually, and so they have schools in little towns where perhaps there's no other private school option, but as a church, they're very committed to that model, and so that's kind of neat to see. You know, our friends in Jewish education, of course, there's not just one form of observance in the Jewish faith, and so you have Orthodox schools and Reform schools, but we see that those synagogues are very committed to, in particular, preschools and lower elementary in their faith, and so we've got friends in Jewish education nationally.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that the biggest area of growth in other private schools have been with our evangelical Christian friends,
mm-hmm.
who, like here in Sacramento, have schools. They're not organized the same way the Catholic Church is, so they might be in an umbrella or a federation, but it's not. The Catholic Church, we're very proud, of course, to have the Holy Father as our spiritual but also organizational leader, and there's a lot of structure to the way that the Catholic Church is organized. And one of the nice things about collaboration with our friends in other faiths is we see that they really do like the partnership with the Catholic Church, and in particular the Catholic Bishops' Conferences, because we do muster a lot of resources and are able to use our size to advocate, of course, for the interest of our own schools, but join in that advocacy with our friends from other faiths as well. You know, very often the Catholic Church is going to be the anchor for advocacy for a broad network of schools of other faiths in particular states or nationally, and we're very proud of that.
And what percent of the private schools are not religious at all?
There's a decent percentage, and it's growing. We have, of course, here in Sacramento, we have some non sectarian private schools.
Sure.
Traditionally, maybe they were a little bit more like the country, the country days of
country,
the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so the country day schools are everywhere nationally. Most of the private schools nationally are religious. People of faiths want their child to receive formation in that faith, and so lots of faiths have organized these networks of schools to make sure that the parents are supporting their kids in raising them in the faith.
Does the NCAA have a role in curriculum?
We do, but not directly. So, of course, every bishop ultimately is responsible for catechesis in his own diocese, mm-hmm. and we're very respectful of that. That stated, the bishops coordinated a couple of ways. On the bishop side, there's a thing called the framework, and so for secondary schools, the bishops nationally agree that there are certain standards or concepts they wanted every Catholic school child to know, and that's on the faith part. On the standards for schools, we do have this document called the National Standards and Benchmarks for Effective Catholic Primary and Secondary Schools. It's a mouthful, but our Catholic schools are accredited, and they're accredited by a combination of secular and religious organizations nationally. And so nationally, there's seven big regional accreditation agencies, and the bishops collaborate with these agencies to make sure that Catholic schools are accredited. Mm-hmm. And so they go through this process, and so the NCEA has the copyright to this document that provides structure for that. So we know that there's just certain things that have to happen in any Catholic school for it to be successful. It's got to have, of course, a Christian anthropology, and has to be Christ-centered and be really focused on strong Catholic identity and good catechesis, but it also has to have good governance, and it has to have good academic programs. And so this document, the Standards and Benchmarks, kind of lays out best practices in all of these big areas to make sure that all of our schools are following them. So it's been a very successful document, and it's a really good way to keep everybody on the same page. I mean, yes, we always lead with Christ, but it's also an expectation of our bishops, and this is church law for us, that every Catholic school has to be excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And they define that as at least as good in terms of programs as the public schools of the same area. And so the bishops have given us an expectation of catechesis and formation, but we also have to be excellent. And so for us as the NCEA, we make sure we provide resources for all schools, all dioceses, to keep them on that track.
Right, that's very interesting, because people go, you don't take public money, and yet there you are. You look at what are the elite high schools here in the Sacramento area? Christian Brothers, Jesuit, Saint Francis, Cristo Rey. You go right through them. Saint Vincent's, Saint Pat's, on and on and on and on. And nationally, you see it too. Besides having pretty good football teams, you look at the top 25 high school football teams in the country, and about 20 of them are Catholic schools. But you're right; they're excellent. They attract a lot of students that aren't Catholic because of their excellence.
And that is if you read the canon, it is church law that our schools have to be excellent, and
yeah.
It's always been that way.
Wow, that's impressive.
Well, we take it very seriously, and I think that. For us, and just to be a little bit theological, we don't believe that human beings are just made to learn things or to do things or to have skills. Education isn't just skills-centered. We believe that human beings are made for greatness.
Right.
So, of course, for us as Catholics, greatness is being prepared to come into union with God.
Right.
But the way we tell it to our little kids is, look, God loves you so much, He's going to want you to do something great for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want our kids to be prepared for that kind of greatness. The gift of Catholic education is that it does prepare students for servant leadership in Christ. And because of that, we teach them all these other skills that aren't just academics. They learn leadership, of course, but they're learning it in a very particular way. You know, it's really interesting if you look at, they talk about persistence, academic persistence in school. So is a child likely to start in kindergarten and go all the way through college? And Catholic schools have very good outcomes in these areas. But it's interesting, a Catholic school child with the same SATs and the same grades is much more likely to finish college.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's because we believe very strongly that it's not just about the grades and it's not just about, you know, how much you know. You know, kids have to be socialized. In other words, they're given a goal, they're given an objective. We want to teach self-esteem and you know, we want our kids to be conscientious. We want them to be assertive. And so a lot of the things you really learn at Catholic school have to do with that. It's not just stuff, facts,
right.
Skills. It's about that those qualities of character that we know are going to help our kids go on to be great servant leaders in Christ.
Wonderful. Lincoln, I can't tell you how good it is to hear your voice and to hear how you're doing and to learn all about the NCEA. And I hope one day soon we can have you back on the program.
Well, looking forward to it anytime. You know, Sacramento is and remains my hometown, and it's always a joy to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Lincoln. God bless you and your family and everybody there at the NCAA. Thanks so much. That's Lincoln Snyder, the president and CEO of the National Catholic Educational Association. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening. God bless everyone. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Ministry of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley & Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley & Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and long-standing support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates.
Well, here I am in a river of questions. Can I pour my heart out to a listening ear? Well, I see this life, it's valleys and mountains, and I think of all the roads that brought me here. Oh, that brought me here. Walking down the road. Well, I've questioned my reasons, this life I'm living. I question my ability to judge wrong from. Well, I questioned all the things I've ever called certain. My race, my religion, my country, my mind. But the one thing I don't
significance, meaning, and relevance. There's the work I'm